And as we did this morning, because there's some children present, I love to encourage them, otherwise known as bribery, reward, take your pick, whatever you like. So anybody here who's 12 years of age or younger, I'm going to offer you a prize. Yes, that's coming up. That's good. We are getting there. And then we're going to give a prize to those who are older, because I don't want you to feel there's ageism happening here or discrimination, right? So for the young ones, we have a choice of two books. Yes, written by yours truly. We enjoy these things because the parents said, our kids are being bombarded with evolution. What have you got? Because they're at kindergarten. You can choose Adam and Eve or the monkeys and the trees, or the other one, How Did Noah Do It? Because that's our subject tonight. On this one deals with, how did Noah get the dinosaurs on the ark? Interesting question. But you see, you can win one of these books if you're 12 years of age and younger, and I'm going to ask several who am I questions. See if you can get it. I had two brothers and two sisters at least. Nobody? Okay. My father died when he was 777. Nobody? Yes?
Noah.
Noah is correct. Out you come. Come on. Are you 12?
No.
Oh, well, that's okay. You can still, that qualifies. Out you come. That was a pretty good guess, hey? I reckon so. Which one do you want? The monkeys or the Noah one? Good on ya. Good on ya. You see, I was going to go and say his brothers and sisters didn't believe him, and he was the first to experience cold weather, because there was no cold mentioned in the Bible until after Noah's day. Only later on would I get, and he built a really big boat. That would have been a dead giveaway, correct? Okay, for the parents, we have a DVD you can win, because it's up the back there, as it was in the days of Noah, and it's just about, hey, Jesus said, as it was in Noah's day, that's what it'll be like at the coming of the Lord again, when the Lord returns to judge the planet a second time. And this is a great DVD because it's not actually about the physical evidence of the flood, but what on earth did Jesus mean? And it's got some questions on the front. Who is 666? Who is 888? What about 777? Those numbers are in the Bible, you know, and they're interesting. Hey, as it was in the days of Noah, this is yours, free of charge, if you can tell me what's the smallest the ark would have been. What's the smallest? 10 seconds. You know, I never usually have to give this away for that question. For one simple reason. Most of us don't take much note of the details. Or with the kids, it was nice and general. But you see, the Bible says we should study to see what's actually in there. The answer is the smallest it would have been, remember it's mentioned in cubits, some of you? And it was 300 cubits long, which meant the average cubit today is half a metre, so it would have been 150 metres long, assuming Noah was our size. What if he was that big? You see, because the boys and girls, they've got cubits that are only that tiny. And if Noah was a pygmy, the ark would have been tiny, wouldn't it? But you see, the average cubit is half a metre, so the ark at smallest would have been about the size. Do you remember the old Queen Mary liner? That's about the smallest the ark would have been. All right, we're up on the board now. You'll notice I've written the creationresearch.net in a different way. This morning we were here looking at Bible teaching with a little bit of science thrown around the edges. Tonight we're looking at research around the theme of the Bible, creationresearch.net. Let's get underway. Oops, once this goes, I will. We do run Jurassic Ark. It's Australia's only creation museum. We have a second one being built in Tasmania. Joseph will tell you about some of the others a little later. And we had a student who got permission to do his work experience. This is a real first. He got his permission to do work experience with creation research. I couldn't believe it. But we gave him some experience. There his hand is. Notice we're very careful not to show students photos. All sorts of legal problems these days. And he's excavating a fossil log. with a big boulder right alongside it. Big rocks and big logs. Oh, you can see he did all this excavation. Three parallel logs with a big rock there. And of course we were teaching him that God's word says you will think, you will love God with your heart, soul and mind. I make no apologies for that. God has given you a brain and he expects you to use it. Okay, what would it mean? Because we set up Jurassic Ark after finding this fossil flood log jam. And we say it's a flood log jam because the trees don't have any roots. And they don't have any branches. And if they don't have any roots, they didn't grow there. If they didn't grow there, they grew somewhere else. If they grew somewhere else, how on earth did they get from somewhere else to here and then get buried before they rotted because they're all pine trees? And pine trees don't last very long, correct? They're softwood. Ah, fossil flood. Something had ripped up a forest, carried along, dumped and buried a... There's thousands of these trees at our fossil excavation site. And every geologist we've had there can't but agree this is a flood deposit. But guess which flood they don't want to go to? They don't want to talk about Noah's flood. Because Noah's flood is not just a story of the first rain. It's not just a story about someone who learned how to build a big boat. It's not just a story of a floating zoo. It's an account of a real God who really hates sin, who really judged man, and he provided a way out of his judgment. That's where most geologists don't want to go. So I tell you what, you can come to our Jurassic Ark because we have the world's first petrified tree sundial. And it's a museum on the evidence of creation. You say, what on earth's a petrified tree sundial got to do with creation? Well, you do know how sundials work, don't you? They tell you the time. And they're very accurate, by the way. In fact, didn't we used to use them before we had these things? We did. They were in every village. And they were more accurate than your watches. Because they told you the exact time for each village. Now you just have a general time, like Eastern Australian time, and the people in Birdsville complain that the sun didn't rise at 6 a.m. Right? Because it's a half hour later out there. Oh, what's it got to do with the evidence of creation? You know, when you want to ask questions like, how would I recognize the evidence of the flood? Or how would I recognize the evidence of creation? The first thing you need to do is read what the Bible says. And then say, given that that's true, what would the evidence be? You know what Genesis 1 says about time? God made the sun and the moon and the stars for signs and times and seasons. You can easily check that. Build a sundial. And you can tell the time from it exactly. Look up tomorrow's newspaper and it will tell you when the sun will rise the next day. Precisely. Talk to one of my friends who worked with the NASA program and he designed the guidance system on the space shuttle. Because you realize when you don't have a roadmap for outer space, you need to know where you've come from, where you're going to and how to get back. Ah, you know what he said? We can tell you where Pluto will be in 10 years' time because the universe works like clockwork. Oh, he's a Christian, by the way, and he's firmly convinced God has stamped his nature on creation and God is the God of law and order and time is one of his best signatures. It's ordered. It's there. It's real. You can check it. Trouble is, I end up debating lots of people who won't even open their Bible. Like this guy here. Atheist biology professor John Turner versus the creation guy John McKay. A couple of years ago now, there's me on the left side, there's that British professor on the right hand side. Now, he was an atheist. In fact, he told us why he was an atheist. We have precious little in the way of... Actually, that's not why he's an atheist. You see, I agree with that statement. He came out and told us we don't have any fossils that show evolution. You know, those so-called missing links? So that can't be the reason he was an atheist. The reason he was an atheist was that the world is so old, evolution must have happened. Hey, isn't that a good reason? Well, is it? You see, if you want to check it, you need to know why he thinks that's evidence for atheism. Because he knows the Bible says in how many days did God make the heavens and the earth? 6 days. So he thinks the world is too old for that to be true. And he's just being logically consistent and wrong at the same time. You see, he's made time the hero of the plot. Given long enough, matter can make itself into professors. British professors, of course. Given long enough, they may be intelligent, because we started out unintelligent. When time is the hero of the plot, God is out. He thinks the world is so old, the rocks took such a long time, that there is no God. And therefore he rejects that. You see, there's our Bible reading for tonight. As we start, Genesis chapter 7, verse 11 and 12, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened, and the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Okay, I could have asked this question. How old was Noah when the flood started? And I could have offered a free $35 book. What would the answer be? 600? Wrong. 600 years, 2 months and 17 days. See how precise that is? By the way, this is a diary. It is a real diary. You see, nobody worries about that sort of precision in fairy stories. How about Red Riding Hood? How old was Red Riding Hood in the story? I mean, come on. What shape were the three pigs' houses? What was their address? Do you realize fairy stories are easy to pick because they're very skimpy on details? But diaries are easy to pick. Noah was 600 years, 2 months and 17 days old. And if you keep reading the story, you find out he got on the ark and then he got off the ark 1 year and 10 days later, because it tells you how old he was. And then you can go through and you figure out, hey, there's this many months. And therefore, there are this many days. And therefore, you figure out, hey, in Noah's life, the months and the days and the years were the same as ours. So this is real years. Oh, do you notice something? This is a different world than the one you and I live in. So if you know your Bible, you'll not only know that there's a story about Noah, you'll know how old he was. You know what was the detail of it. You know how long he was on the ark, when he got off, and what happened to the creatures in between. And that's where you get the traditional chronologists saying Adam lived about 6,000 years ago. Noah lived 4,300 years ago. Amazing. You can do it too. I've done it myself. Added it up. Takes a bit of time. But you see, Professor John Turner rejected that because he believed Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. Do you realize Charles Darwin trained at Edinburgh University? He started out as a medical surgeon, and he puked up at the first operation he watched, so he pulled out a medicine. And he went and he studied other things like theology. He was training to be an Anglican pastor. After all, if you can't do anything practical, say, you may as well become a clergyman. That was his father's attitude, because his dad was an atheist. And he funded Charles Darwin's study as a theologian. Ah, Charles Darwin, he became Charles Lyell's disciple. Oh, you never hear about Charles Lyell, but his name is just up the road. You have Lake Lyell off to the left there just before you get to Lithgow. You see, Charles Darwin and Charles Lyell are together here, and they're a lot to do with why that professor does not believe in creation or in Noah's flood. You see, Charles Lyell is on record. His aim was to get rid of Moses. Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Moses, creation, sin, Noah's flood, Babel, the law of God. And he's been very successful. Okay, 1859, Charles Darwin published The Origin of Species. Come on, some of you went on the trip yesterday. When was Charles Darwin passing Hazelbrook? I mean, he's gone up the other road. When was he doing that? 1836. Before his theory of evolution. But he was already influenced by Charles Lyell, because when he landed in Sydney, he had a copy of Charles Lyell's book about millions of years and Noah's flood. Remember what I said this morning? The first attack on Christianity was not evolution. It was get rid of the flood. Then get rid of the 6 days. Then are you able to substitute evolution? See what Darwin writes? I always feel as if my books came half out of Lyell's brain. And I never acknowledge this sufficiently. That's why you've never heard of this. It's true though. There's an interesting book on the real history of geology. By the latter part of the 19th century, Lyell and Darwin were using rates of erosion, that's how fast the mountain wears down, to estimate the Earth was hundreds of millions of years old. Hey, I thought the Earth was 4.6 billion years old. Well, it is now. It wasn't 20 years ago, and it wasn't 50 years ago, and it wasn't when Darwin was writing the book. You see, when Darwin was at theological college, reading from the Bible, anyone remember how old they said the world was in the 1820s, 1830s? 6,000 years. Because they still believed there was a real creation, there was a real Noah's flood, there was a real history. Amazing. So therefore the professor says, I can't believe the Bible is real history. Oh, you can actually see this debate. We made an agreement that this debate will be done for school students. So it was a very polite debate. None of this sort of scratch the eyeball of your opponent out or do things like that. But it's done for schools. So therefore, you'll get a lot out of it. And the funny thing was, well, you were there. Did the professor win? No. It was tragic, really. And he lost big time. Just about everything he said turned out to be fallacious. Don't take my word. Look up our YouTube and actually follow it through. So here's what we're going to do. Are you ready, kids, for some good information? Because we need to ask a few questions first. How old was Noah when the flood started? Don't say 600. It was 600 years, 2 months and 17 days. And when he got off, 1 year and 10 days later, he was 600 years, 2 months and 27 days old. Hey, that means it was more than 27 days in a month. Did you catch that? In fact, don't we average 30 days in a month? Don't we do that because once every 29 and a half days, the moon goes round the earth and that's a month? Yes, that's where we get it from. Real figures, real calculations. But there's a question. When water first covered the earth, how long did it rain? Anybody know? 40 days and 40 nights? No, it didn't. You see, Noah's flood is the second time the world was covered with water. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved on the face of the waters. Do you realize the earth never was a hot, molten blob? Right from the beginning, it was covered with water. So when people say, where did all the water come from that covered all the earth? You now know the answer. It was always there. There was always enough water to cover the earth. A more interesting question might be, where did it go to between the third day when the dry land appeared and Noah's flood? But nobody's asking that question tonight. You see, by the time you get to Genesis chapter 2, it's emphatic there was no rain. Wow, what a different planet. The earth was covered with water when God first created it, and there was no rain. Amazing. From outer space, that's what it would look like. By the way, there was no sun, no moon, no stars, no other planets. That's all it was. When was the first rain? You know that now. In the 600th year of Noah's life. Yeah, we won't need to go through that. You see, at the beginning of Noah's flood. Now you know why the New Testament says Noah believed things that had not yet been seen. Nobody has seen rain. If there's no rain, you've never seen a flood. This guy really trusted God's word. In fact, he could have said, God, you say it's going to be a flood, but I haven't got the foggiest what a flood is. You say it's going to be rain, but I don't know what you mean. What are we talking about here? Just trust me, says God. Yeah, and by the way, if you're a Christian, that's the way God will sometimes ask you to trust him. How big was the flood? And the waters prevailed exceeding upon the earth, and all the high hills that run to the whole heaven were covered. All the high hills, you've got a few high hills around here, haven't you? But it says, all the high hills under the whole of heaven. Do you realize now why when Christians have read the Bible and believe what it says, the flood covers the whole earth? But don't be surprised, this is the second time the waters covered the earth. It's not the question of how much water that was needed, there was always enough water. But then if you want to know where it went to, you can ask us in question time, can't you? Amazing. But there's a good question. How did the Australian kangaroos get to the ark? You see, when you look at your Bible, you now know there's an answer to the skeptic's question. Where did the water come from? There's an answer to the skeptic's question like, how did Noah fit two blue whales on the ark? But I haven't mentioned what the answer is. But you see, if you read the details, you can figure out what the answers are. God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered into one place and let the dry land appear, and it was so. How many oceans are there? One. So therefore, how many blobs of land are there? One. Okay, did the kangaroos need to swim from Australia to the Middle East to get to Noah's Ark? No. There wasn't any Middle East. And I hate to tell you Aussies this, but there was no Australia either, and the Americans take that really hard when they find there was no America, right? Okay, there was only one ocean. So if you had 100 years, which is the time it took Noah to build the ark, then you could have hopped anywhere you liked on planet Earth. One continent of land. There's a picture. One mass of water, one continent. There was no summer, no winter, no rain. A mist rose up every morning and watered the whole surface of the earth, so it would have been beautifully lush. No winter, no frost, no ice. The sort of ideal existence that you and I would love, particularly in the middle of July when you're up on top of the Blue Mountains like we were the other day, preparing your field trip, and solid white stuff came down on us. Do you realise that's miserable stuff? Particularly if you're Adam and Eve and you're naked. Alright? But you see, it wasn't a problem. They were created for the perfect weather that existed. You see, how did kangaroos get to the ark? Once you know that, all you need to know is they didn't have to swim. Hopping is all they would have needed to do. How did dinosaurs get to the ark? Well, he won a book. The rest of you can use your credit card or your mother's credit card and buy one up the back and support the ministry here. You see, one of the things that the Lord has impressed on us over the years is that you need to beware of false science because it leads you astray. You know, one of the guys who became a Christian through our ministry, he'd rejected Christianity for so long because he thought monkeys turned into people. Look, we're so like them, we must have come from them. He'd rejected Christianity because the world was so old, and like that professor, he'd blocked Christ out. And somebody loaned him our DVD, Darwin, Time's Up Darwin, and now he's a Christian. Because he actually discovered he'd been given false science. Well, a young man who's in the business of being called to give true science is the guy I'm just about to introduce, Indiana Joe. Would you like to come out here? In fact, Indiana Joe is right beside my grandson Ben, who's working for the ministry at the moment, and we've come up with a new line of T-shirts. Show them your chest when you get out here. It's not all hairy, it's just all black and covered with T-shirt, which is great. And if you're looking for witnessing T-shirts, then you can get these online as well. And listen, I think there's a bone there that you and I need to talk about. Okay. Because before I hand over to Joseph, and I'm not sure how we're going to do this, in fact, you can take it round a bit, give them a bit of a look at, because we've given you a general framework. Now we need to talk about the fact I mentioned, hey, let some of the kids touch it. In fact, kids, you can touch it if you like. It's a dinosaur bone, a real one. I was on a dig 3 years ago, and we brought back a ton of those things. Don't let him hold it by himself. He might drop it. And I mean, it's millions of years old, so it's got to be fragile. Sorry, I should have said that. The reality is, you and I live in a world where that's what the average person thinks, and they think it died and fell to the ground and slowly got covered up, so there's no evidence for creation at all. But Joseph, we can't sort of share this back as a... You shout, that's good. Okay, now we had a problem recently, didn't we?
Yes.
Yes, okay, and the Lord has enabled us to solve it recently.
He's very good to
know. And it's related to our subject tonight. So, hey, there he is, a young man with a...
Look at there we go, that's excellent, good. There we go.
Okay, now listen, you give that to me to hold because I don't have to hold a microphone.
Okay.
And we had a problem, you see. The owner of the property that this is on, way out near the Northern Territory border, is happy for us to come and get this stuff with a couple of provisos. We don't tell the academics. He doesn't like academics, right? And when you actually want to identify a dinosaur, the first question the expert asks you is, where did you get it from? Because the next step is to look up their books and see on a chart of how old it is. And what it's evolved from. Isn't that what they do?
Yeah, absolutely. They always want to know where it's come from.
Uh-huh. But straight away. Restriction. So over the last couple of years, we reached a conclusion, we just didn't have one dinosaur. And in fact, I told you that when you got off the plane.
When we got for the first time, yes.
We had two vertebrae in the office. I showed you both of them, correct?
Yep.
And do you agree that they look like...
Yeah, they are definitely two different types of backbone.
Come over here, please. Turn around. Bend over a little, because this is a tailbone. Let them all see. Come on, I mean, you're a real dinosaur. It's a big tailbone, isn't it, Joseph?
Yes.
In fact,
that's from down near the end as well, so you can just imagine how big it is.
The end of the tail. So this dinosaur is 15 to 20 metres long. That's from the back of the room up to the middle of the stage. That's a decent dinosaur. But we reached the conclusion there were two separate dinosaurs.
We did, yes.
And we were still stuck.
Yep.
Because John Mackay is not regarded as a world expert. Joseph, he's just a pom. Oh, so he's doing geology, but... tell us how the Lord enabled us to find out what these were, and then I'll make the connection with the subject tonight.
Yeah, so basically, when I arrived in Australia, John gave me these two bones to have a look at. I agreed with him, we've got two separate dinosaurs, but we didn't have a clue what they were. Now, back in the UK, had met a guy called Dean Lomax, who was a paleobiologist like me, and his specific job was to go around old museums and basically go through all of their old collections and, you know, get the random bits of bones and stuff and try and work out exactly what dinosaur or creature they had actually come from, right? So he's a world expert in this kind of stuff, actually being able to identify random bits of bones with no information attached to them. And I just happened to bump into him at a lecture. I was on holiday at the time, and I just happened to see it advertised. So I went to go and see the lecture. It was very interesting. But the most interesting part, and the bit where you can really see God working, is at the end, he was waiting to have somebody come and pick him up and take him away. And I was waiting to have somebody come and pick me up and take me away. So we spent about an hour and a half on the steps outside of the museum where the lecture was held, just chatting. And we went over all sorts of different things, creation, evolution. He was an evolutionist. He did believe in that. But he did say that he kind of understood where I was coming from, really respected what I believed and some of the challenges that I gave him. So he's a lovely guy. We'd chatted and we stayed in contact since then. And so when John presented me with this problem, I thought, I know exactly who I need to contact. I need to get in touch with Dean because this is what he does for a living. So I sent him a couple of photos. First of all, I sent him that bone there and a little bit of filming of it as well. He had a look over it and he came back to me and said, yeah, this is definitely a large sauropod dinosaur. They're the ones, you know, with the big long necks, right? The titanosaurs. So he said, this is definitely the tailbone, the caudal vertebrae is the proper Latin name for it. So the tailbone of a large land sauropod dinosaur. We thought, excellent, that's really good news. We've got identification for this dinosaur. And then we sent him the other one, the one that we suspected was a different type of dinosaur. And he came back to us and he said, yes, this is a different type of dinosaur, you're absolutely right. He said, this is definitely one of the vertebrae, the tail vertebrae, of a large marine dinosaur. One of the big swimming dinosaurs, like a plesiosaur or a pliosaur. You know, the big swimming dinosaurs with the big long necks.
Oh, I'd better take over from
here. You can take over from here.
Because, you see, I was out there collecting, and the bones are side by side. Big land creature, big sea creature, side by side. Can you see the implication? Do you think the sea creature crawled out on the land, walked around, and died and got buried quickly? Or did the land creature get washed out to sea where they both got buried side by side? And if they did, I mean, come on, let's be honest. How deep has the water got to be to wash our dinosaur off the land into the sea and bury it before it rots so all the tail bones are there? I got sacks and sacks and sacks and sacks of these bones. Amazing. Do you realize this is a flood deposit? It really is. And in fact, if you're interested in our ministry, we also found a skull, a giant skull. If you want to help us go back and get it, I've rung the property owner with the identifications. He's really excited. And that would be wonderful to have a creation research dinosaur in a creation research museum with evidence of Noah's flood because of how the bones. Noah's flood. We're going to be talking about looking at dinosaurs tonight, aren't
we? We certainly are, yes.
And in fact, would you like to take over? And I'll come back a little later.
Very good, right. So what I'm going to do is, yeah, I will be talking a bit about Noah's flood and a little bit about the evidence. But before I do, for some of you who don't know who I am or haven't heard much about me, I did a little bit of an introduction as to who I am this morning. But I'll go into a little bit more detail here and a bit about some of the stuff that I do and the stuff that I run throughout, well, mostly in the UK. So, like I was mentioned this morning, I am a geology student. I study paleobiology, and I'm coming up towards the end of my degree course in that. Paleobiology is basically looking at fossils and also looking at what they're buried in, what they're buried with, looking at the big picture, trying to work out where they lived and trying to work out how they lived. And just as we touched on a minute ago with the dinosaurs, most of the time it's a bit of a nightmare unless you are a creationist. Simply because you've got land things and marine things mixed in together, and you can never make a good, you know, ecosystem or reconstruct a place where those two creatures were living side by side, simply because one comes from the deep ocean, one comes from the land. So it's a bit of a nightmare for most people, but it's excellent evidence of a flood deposit. So I also do, university is not the cheapest thing in the world, so in order to help pay for university, I also work at this place as a zookeeper. Raw Dinosaur Adventure. It's a ridiculous name. It used to be called the Dinosaur Adventure Park, which was much better, but they decided to change it to this for some reason. But it has given me a lot of experience with biology, because I do have to work with a lot of animals, and we do have to get to have a lot of fun as well. So we've got some, you know, really exotic things there. We've got some not so exotic things. That's one of my colleagues there. That is Clarice, the iguana there. She loves to climb up on people's heads. You get to see some of your lovely animals here. This is one of the bearded dragons. It's about two months old there. About 5 weeks old when we took that photograph. We get to take lots of big animals and take them out and show them to people as well. And people can come and hold them. I mean, look at some of the size of these things. Do you know what? They're even smaller compared to the fossil ones. The fossil cockroaches were huge. And I always like to show people this one. So this is Bert, the tortoise. Bert sadly died a couple of years back now. Well, actually, it was last year. But through the world of zookeeping, there was a little game that became very popular, which was to get photographs of zookeepers with their animals and then reconstruct those photographs using that zookeeper's colleagues. And this is what we came up with. So I always like doing that. Here's another one of your animals in the snow. They do not like the snow at all, the wallabies. So I do a little bit of zookeeping. It's given me a lot of experience with animals and zoology, which has really, really helped with my paleobiology, because it does help me get an idea of how animals live and how they interact with their environment. But regards to ministry, this is one of the biggest things I do. I run this place, the Genesis Museum of Creation Research. There's our logo. Here's some photographs from inside. It's developed even more since these photographs were taken. We have over 3,000 fossils in there. On display, plus we have archaeology displays, we have natural science displays, we've got lots of living animals down there as well that people can come and meet and hold. So we've got lots and lots of stuff in there. And by the way, that 3,000 fossils that we've got on display in there is about a third of the total amount of fossils that we have on that property. We've got two very large sheds which are literally stacked to the roof full of fossils from all the research that we've done. And that's all of those fossils together is probably about a quarter of the amount of fossils that we've got ready to go on display in the UK. So we're constantly looking for places to redo our museum and, you know, make it bigger and better. So as well as running the museum and doing talks like this and leading field trips, as you saw some of that this morning, I do a lot of research. When I do research, most of the time my family come with me. I come from quite a large family. There we all are. Even the very young ones will come along. And this is where we were heading down towards some mines to go and have a look for some evidence for stalactites. So they'll come with me even into the depths of caves. So it's a little bit about me, a little bit about what I do. But tonight I'm going to be talking about this. Fossils. Millions of years, Noah's flood. You see, people are fascinated by fossils. They think they're wonderful. You know, one of the great things that I love to do, because I'm a big believer in very hands-on kind of science, hands-on experience, when people come around to the museum, we love to get them out and be able to let them touch fossils and actually see fossils for themselves, because people love it. People are really fascinated by it. And you go to the Natural History Museum in London, quite a famous natural history museum in the terms of World Natural History Museums. I visited there the day before I flew out here, and they've got some fantastic fossils all over the place. But, you know, they are all promoting, in all of these museums, in all of the books you read, in the university textbooks, in the history books, you know, science books that you read, they're all promoting this idea. Fossilization from creature to a fossil is a really slow process. This is what you will find in all the museums, in all the books that you read, in all the university textbooks. And here's some visual aids that you tend to find in these museums. How do you get a fish fossil? Well, to start off with, a fish dies and sinks to the bottom of the lake. The fish rots away and only the bones are left, and the fish is covered with mud. Slowly, over millions of years, the mud turns into rock, and over time, the bone matter is completely changed into mineral matter, and the fish is now a fossil. Sounds pretty straightforward. Sounds pretty logical. But you know, I always like to remind people about this. Test all things. Hold fast to what is good. And as I mentioned this morning, that is a perfect example of what we're supposed to do as scientists. You have an idea, you have a thought, you see an observation, you test it. If it's good, you hold on to it. If it's bad, you get rid of it. But this isn't in a science textbook. This isn't in a university lecture. This is in the Bible. This is what Jesus is telling us to do. Test all things and only hold fast to what is good. So take you to our museum, have a look at a fantastic new fossil that has been donated to us just a couple of weeks ago. This fossil here. It's a fish fossil. Have you noticed the unusual thing about it yet? It's got another fish coming out of its mouth. Now, when I first saw this, I instantly thought, oh, this fish is eating this fish. But it's actually not. What's interesting is that it's actually already been eaten. Can you see the teeth marks? This fish has been eaten by this bigger fish, and then that bigger fish has been buried so quickly that and with so much pressure that smaller fish has gone boop, and it's come out again. Hasn't had any time to digest. And look at the stunning detail on these fish. These fossil rocks are fast fossil rocks. You couldn't have millions of years pass before this fish was fossilized. And we've got even some other ones in our collection. This is some of the ones that John has got in his collection here in Australia. Some fantastic, look at the detail on some of these fish. You see this fish? This fish is displaying exactly the same scenario as what our fossil fish we've got back in the UK is. The only difference is this fish that he swallowed has been a bit digested. This is a fossil fish that is vomiting. It's been buried so quickly and so rapidly with so much pressure that fish has, you know, digested vomit inside its stomach has been squeezed out of its mouth. And do you remember how it said that fish fossilize? It said, first of all, fish are swimming along, fish dies, fish sinks to the bottom and slowly gets covered with mud. Well, let's test that. Because the first thing that we can point out is when fish die, yes, they all do sink to the bottom. But the majority of them will then float, and then stay at the top. They don't stay, most of them don't stay down in the bottom. Because they've got what we call air bladders, air sacs, right? It helps keep the fish buoyant as it's swimming, as it's alive. And when it dies, these will bloat and will make the fish float. And once the fish is floating, he can't get buried in mud. He will slowly rot away and slowly become fossilized. Test all things, hold fast to what is good. And I put that up there again because we had a critique. And we've had a few of them this time, over the years. But this is a critique specifically about this point that we make about fish floating, okay? Under some conditions, fish can sink and stay on the sea floor. This is right. If the water is cold, the air bladders can't actually expand and the fish will stay down on the bottom of the sea. Therefore, they say, the fish that sinks to the bottom of the floor can become fossilized. Therefore, you can get fish fossils without a flood and or catastrophic burial. That is the argument that is used. That is the critique that is used. So we thought we need to do some investigation into this, and the Lord really blessed us because just over a week ago, I was giving this talk, and a guy came up to me afterwards and said, "Oh, I'm a fish farmer. I've spent all my life, farming fish and looking after fish to be used in the food industry." And he said, "I noticed you said about the fish sinking." He said, "You're right." He said, "Almost every time the fish will sink to the bottom, but then a lot of them will bloat and float." He said, "But we were finding a really, really difficult problem." He said, "Because when the fish died and when the fish sank to the bottom, most of the time something happened before they had chance to bloat and float. This is what happened. Meet the Spirulina fungus." He said that this fungus, he said, "This is a nightmare, this fungus." He said, "What would happen is the fish would sink, stay on the bottom of the floor of the tank where they were farming them. And he said, this fungus would come up in a matter of hours before the fish had time to bloat and float. He said, this fungus would crawl over it." This is in the cold water, right? When the fish was sinking, he said, "The fungus would crawl over it and attach it to the floor. That fungus is already waiting on the floor. And as soon as the fish touches it, it begins to crawl on and begins to digest the fish. And it keeps the fish down on the floor. It attaches it to the bottom of the floor. And within a few hours, it begins to destroy the fish. Within a few days, the fish is completely gone." Question: would you get a fish fossil slowly, even if the fish sank and stayed there? No. The fish would be destroyed long before it was fossilized. And you certainly wouldn't get the stunning detail that we see in the majority of fossil fish that we find. The point which I'm going to be making over and over again tonight: fossilization has got nothing to do with time. Time will destroy your fossils, not create it. If you want to get a fossil fish, you need a process. Get the right process, and you can make a fossil fish very, very quickly. So let's talk about some dinosaurs. We've already briefly talked about dinosaurs and some of the research we're doing and some of the bones. You'll be able to come up, I'm sure we'll be able to have the bone out the back somewhere, so those who didn't get a chance to see it can come up and see it later. But let's have a look at some dinosaurs, because I love dinosaurs. And most people like dinosaurs as well. I think they're fantastic things. I mean, look at some of the things we can dig up out of the rocks. They're absolutely fantastic. Now, I go digging up dinosaurs. I'd love to come here at some point and help excavate that dinosaur that John was saying about, that he found, on this guy's property. But most of my digging of the dinosaurs has happened in this place, the Isle of Wight. And the simple reason is because the Isle of Wight is the sixth best place in the world for diversity of dinosaur fossils. You get a lot of stuff there, not many people that. This is a little island down off the south coast of Britain. And they've got some fantastic cliffs there. It can be quite dangerous getting up to where the dinosaurs are. You have to put yourself in a lot of precarious situations. But the results are usually fantastic. This is one of the jawbones which we use where I work. That's better. So you can find some really, really fantastic stuff. But here's a question. How do we know that dinosaurs existed? Very, very simple question. We've been talking about it all day. Fossils. Yeah, quasi-fossils. It's very, very simple. We know dinosaurs existed simply because we find their fossils. It's undeniable that dinosaurs existed. But when you go out on the field and when you begin to dig up dinosaurs and you begin to look through their bones, you can ask yourself some questions. This is what you do as a scientist. Questions like, how do dinosaur fossils form? What evidence do they show? Do they show evidence of millions of years and a slow burial? Or do they show evidence of a quick flood burial? Well, we'll take you back to Jurassic Ark. John already mentioned this evening. They've got some dinosaurs at Jurassic Ark, including one of these. This is a Coelophysis dinosaur. Can you notice it's in a funny sort of position? You see, we love dinosaurs, but specifically we love this particular dinosaur because it shows us something very, very important. What does it show us? Well, let's take you to the Natural History Museum in London, because they have exactly the same kind of dinosaur. But they are promoting that this dinosaur died very slowly and was slowly fossilized over millions of years. Here's the general story, very similar to the fish story. You've got a dinosaur up here. The dinosaur collapses and dies. The flesh rots away and only the bones remain. The water level rises and sediment buries the bones and the footprints. And then look, slowly, the bones very gradually fossilize and then after a long time, as the erosion comes along, you get these dinosaur bones exposed. Very similar story to the fish. Same conclusion. Fossilization from creature to fossil is a very slow process. Again, test all things. Let's do some testing. Let's take you to Alberta, southern Alberta in Canada, to the Badlands. Famous place for fossils. Fantastic fossils you can find there as well. Look at this guy. Great big theropod dinosaur. His head is sticking in the air. His mouth is open. He's in a bit of a funny position. Look, his tail's in the air. Legs are bent backwards. Why is he in this position? It's a bit of a weird position for a dinosaur to be in. But you know what? This is not unique. There are lots of dinosaurs in this position. Here's another one. Head bent back, tail in the air, legs bent back. Here's another one. Head in the air, mouth open, legs bent back, crumpled up underneath him, tail in the air. There he is, on display. There's another one from Germany. This is not just from Alberta in Canada. This one's from Germany. This one is from Italy. Same thing, head in the air, tail bent back. This one's from Nigeria in Africa. Again, same thing. Can you see? The skull is sort of buried up under here, but the same thing. Look, there's the vertebrae, tail in the air, head in the air, legs bent backwards. What is going on with all these dinosaurs found in this strange position all over the world? Well, let's have a look and see what new scientists say about it. Now, new scientists, certainly no friend of the creationist, but this is what they had to say about these mysterious dinosaurs. Many dinosaurs are found with their head and neck bent backwards and their tail arched over their back. Immersion in water is the simplest explanation. Interesting. Take you to another famous fossil site in Canada. Dasbletosaurus. Some marvellous names these dinosaurs have got. Let's have a look and see what they say about this dinosaur, because notice it's in the same position. They call it the dead dino position, okay? Head in the air, tail bent backwards, legs scrunched up underneath. What do they have to say about Dasbletosaurus? Their death pose. Dasbletosaurus was a large carnivore with powerful jaws. Collected in 1985, this skeleton exhibits a classic death pose. A lot of dinosaurs are found like this. With the neck pulled back over its body, the tail arched forward, and the hind limbs are tightly flexed. This pose is common among the park's meat-eating dinosaurs and is an indication of a central nervous system trauma at the time of death related to drowning. Interesting. Here's a picture of some dinosaurs drowning. Now, you could be forgiven to thinking this was some creationist drawing that tried to show how dinosaurs drowned in Noah's flood, but you'd be very wrong. This is a little plaque, an information plaque, at Dinosaur Provincial Park. And they are by no means a supporter of Noah's flood and creation. But they've got here these dinosaurs being surrounded by water in a great big flood, the dinosaurs drowning, being buried, and then being dug up. Just like this one that we've got at Jurassic Ark. You see, these dinosaurs are found all over the world, these drowned dinosaurs. Remember we said about central nervous system trauma? These dinosaurs are being drowned, and at the very last minute, everything in their body, everything in their nervous system is desperately trying to get their last gasp of air, and so their head goes up, the tail goes up, and they go, and then they die. These dinosaurs are drowning all over the world. The ones in Canada, Alaska, South America, ones in Italy, ones in Africa, ones even down here in Australia. But you know, the story doesn't really stop there, because all these dinosaurs have provably drowned, right? But let's have a look at some more research, because further research that they did into this shows that these dinosaurs had to be buried within 3 minutes of dying, or otherwise they would revert back to their natural pose. This is a central nervous system trauma, right? They're desperately trying to get their last breath, and just as they die, their head goes up, they're trying to get their last breath, tail goes up, and then they die. But within 3 minutes, I mean, they're dead now, so their body will relax, their muscles will loosen up, and they'll flop back into a much more normal dead dinosaur position, and then would die and be sort of sink like that. So these dinosaurs had to be buried within 3 minutes before they had chance, in other words, to go back to a normal dead dinosaur pose. So what can we see? Is that better? There we go. So what can we tell about these? So we've got dinosaurs, a few points, okay? We've got dinosaurs that are found all over the world that have drowned. These dinosaurs have been buried in water. They've been drowned. They've been buried very rapidly, within 3 minutes, all over the world. This is starting to look, sound like a worldwide flood. I think the batteries might be going on this because the clip's going out. I'll put this down. I'll just talk about it. This is starting to sound like a worldwide flood. Again, I make the point. It's not about time. It's about a process. If you get the process right, you can create fossils very, very quickly. It doesn't matter whether it's fish fossils. It doesn't matter whether it's dinosaur fossils. You need to have the right process. Time will only destroy your creature before you have a chance to turn it into a fossil. And when you look at it with that perspective, plus the fact that things like dinosaurs and these fish were buried very, very quickly underwater all over the world, you've got some excellent evidence for Noah's flood. Again, I like to remind people, get the latest creation evidence news, and we'll have updates about all the new research that we do. We travel all over the globe finding new research. We do different stuff all over the time. The evidence news comes out once every couple of weeks. It's a fantastic resource, and it's free as well, which is always a nice price to go with. Just go online and find it. And I also remind you, I did mention about Indiana Joe this morning. It was actually one of the your Australian supporters that named me Indiana Joe, and I do quite like the name, so I kind of adopted it. And I even started a blog, which I started for the time that I came out here to Australia, indianajoe.blog. I will continue it once I get back to the UK as well. Basically updates about where I've been, what research I've been doing, and a little bit like that. So I would encourage you to go on there, hit the subscribe button, and you get a notification whenever I post anything new, videos, articles, all the like. So I believe we are now going to have a question and answer time, as that is the next slide there. I will let John take over.
That's very good, and I thank you for that, Joseph. I appreciate being involved in the talk tonight. We do have a section after Joe's section, and we'd finish with another question time as well. I'd encourage you, Joseph and I are hitting the road for 6 weeks now, from here to the big rock in the centre and back again. So if you'd like to read what we're doing, keep in touch with Joe's blog. And also, if you don't yet get our newsletter, if you didn't get that in the last month, you're not on Creation Research's mailing list. We have print ones, we have electronic ones. There's this whole outline of the trip in there. And if you'd like to support the research, particularly going to... You want to come on this dig too?
I thought you would.
That's okay. You'd be welcome. We are looking for people to support that trip because it's way out on the edge of the desert, and even just the water, we have to carry everything. But it's a really exciting thing. But if you enjoyed what Joe's done in fossils and did a great job, I'd encourage you to look at books like that up the back, because indirectly, that supports what we're doing as well. Okay, now you can ask Joseph or myself or both of us questions on this morning or tonight. And the reason we're pausing here is tonight is a information-rich night. We don't want to lose you. Right, so remember this morning we looked at why a Christian can't believe in evolution, and this evening we've started with a professor who said he was an atheist because the world was so old, and there's an overlap between why they believe the world is so old and how we get to the information on Noah's flood. Okay, so if you've got questions on that or dinosaurs, now's your chance. We'll let you have a couple of questions. We'll get you to stand up, turn around. We'll do that before you have questions. So stand up, turn around, get that blood circulating, and then sit down again. That's the way. That wiggle, wiggle on the whips, that does well. Okay. All right. Has anybody got a question? Yes, young man. What bone? This is a tailbone, right, on a Titanosaurus. Right, that's the one with its neck basically up to those lights. Right, this is a big creature. And the skull we've found, because we can only see one section of it at the moment, is most probably from the big marine one, isn't it? Right, so that's what we found.
It's a very big skull.
Very big skull. And there's no roads, there's no, we have to take our own stuff, four-wheel drive tractors and all of that sort of stuff if we want to get out there. And that will be quite an expensive job, but a very exciting one. So keep praying for us in that, and pray for us as we hit the road for the next 6 weeks and do schools and colleges and churches and things like that. Okay, any other question? That was an easy one, mate. Look up titanosaurs and see how big they are.
How long
Joseph, how long would it take a bone to become fossilized?
Well, an easy way to look at it is modern day bones and see how long it takes for them to decay. And then you've got yourself an idea of how quick you'd have to fossilize a bone, right? For any of you who came out on the field trip with us yesterday, you'll have known we found some sort of dead kangaroo bones and some dead pig bones as well. And the one thing you will notice about them, the same as if you find any sort of, you know, roadkill bones along the side of the road, is that they've been bleached white by the sun. And then over time, and we're talking within, you know, within a couple of months, those bones that have been bleached white will continue to be bleached, and that will cause them to go very brittle. And they will have been gnawed on by various animals, and they will begin to crumble away. And basically the easiest way of doing it is going and having a walk around the town and seeing how many dead things you find. Because if it wasn't for the fact that they'd be destroyed very quickly and broken down, either by animals or just the natural processes, they would be up to our neck in dead creatures, but we're not, right? So they do decay and they do break down very, very quickly. So you're talking within a couple of months, your basic bones will have been destroyed and be destroyed by sun or wind or frost or whatever, right? But when you dig up the bones in the fossil record, what you find is that they do not show any sign of being, you know, left around in the sun for a while. You can see you've still got what we call the skin of the bone, the really, really soft bit on there. We've still got all of the detail. There's no sort of major chunks missing or bits where they've been cracked off or anything like that at all. So you're looking at the level of preservation in the bones that you dig up, and they are tip-top preservation. So you've got to get them buried, certainly within a couple of months, and fossilized before they have chance to be bleached and scavenged and the like, right? But then when you look at stuff like the position that they're in with relation to the rest of the body, like I mentioned tonight about the dinosaurs, they're in this very, very bizarre and strange pose, right? Which has to be mean they have to be buried and preserved within 3 minutes, or otherwise they would revert back to their original pose. Now, in order to get a fossil, you need 3 things. You need to have them buried very quickly, you need to have them buried deeply, and you need to have them buried without the presence of oxygen. If you don't have those 3 things together at the same time, you won't get a fossil. Because if it's not buried deep, they will be scavenged, and there won't be enough pressure to impregnate the bone with minerals. If you don't get it buried quickly, then you're going to have either it reverting back to the original pose, or you'll have it like the kangaroo bones and the various other bones you find on the side of the road. They'll be bleached, they'll be picked dry, and they'll will slowly dissolve and crumble away. And if you do those 2 things and you still have got oxygen, still you'll get bacteria and decay in there, and you'll end up with the same problem, the same process, right? So in reality, you can test, it's easier to test the maximum amount of time that you could get to fossilize it just by looking at natural processes of bones today. And you're looking within the order of a few months to a year, a couple of years maximum, right? Not the millions of years that is promoted. But then when you look at it all together, all the evidence, you look at the big picture, and you look at, like what I was talking tonight about dinosaurs, you realize that fossilization has got to be a really, really quick process. And we're talking within minutes to hours.
Okay. This one here has suffered a bit of damage because it came from the cliff up there and fell out of the cliff, which is how we found the first lot, tumbling down the cliff, hitting other rocks. So it has suffered some damage, but this is not the damage that's with the bone when it's buried.
Yeah. Right, when you dig up fresh bones, you will find they are in pristine condition. That's what we'd call post-depositional trauma to the bone, where it's come out of the cliff.
The other thing, we set up an experiment that produced a result we weren't even expecting. We set up at our Jurassic Ark a fossil pit, so the kids could learn how to dig up dinosaur bones. You mightn't have ever done it, it's not a common thing, but you don't just go in with a big D8 tractor and dig a hole, right? You've got to find the bones, and to do that, you usually use some sort of prodder that you can gently put down through the dirt, and when it goes clink, you've either got a rock or a bone, but you get good ears after a while. Bone sounds are different than rock sounds. And so after that, you then carefully excavate the bone and take it away with you. But in doing this, we set up a big sand pit. We have a few hunters and farmers who support the work. So we've got pig skulls and cow vertebrae and wild deer and all that sort of stuff buried in this big pit. But it rained all January and February. We buried them in November and December. And the first school to come through was in March. So they'd been buried for 3 months. And what was interesting, even though we buried the animals' bones, and they were mostly bleached, they'd been lying around for a while, in that 3 wet months, the iron in the ground had soaked into the bones and they were unbelievably heavy. And we've had quite a few experts there who'd look at this and they say, that looks like it's been buried for 50,000 years. No, not time, but process. One reason this is heavy is iron has soaked into the holes. So it's a difference between a fossil and something that's petrified. Petrified means other minerals have moved into it, right? You can get petrified trees or you can get preserved trees, right? Yesterday we found a petrified tree up the top, didn't we? A pine tree. The minerals had moved in and replaced the wood. In this one, the minerals had moved into the holes because bones are full of holes. And you could actually find some where it's totally replaced and this will all be iron or silica or something. So there's grades of fossils, but this one has got iron in it, so it's heavy, and it only took 3 months. Not 3 years, not 3 million years. Okay, one more question before we move on to part two, yeah? It depends on how much money you're putting in the offering. Can I answer the first bit of this and then you can take over? Because once if that lady already bought the book Dragon, she'd know the answer to that question. But anyway, it's really good up there. There you go.
Okay, right. So basically, yes, we do believe dinosaurs were on Noah's Ark. There's a very simple reason as to why. If you read the Bible where it says about what kind of animals went on Noah's Ark, it said two of every land dwelling, air-breathing animal. And by that category, dinosaurs were exactly that. We talk about things like the land dinosaurs, the marine dinosaurs, and the flying dinosaurs. With a technical definition, dinosaurs only refer to those who are on the land. The marine ones are large marine reptiles, and the flying ones are large flying reptiles, so they don't actually come under the same classification as dinosaurs. But for the time being, we'll just group them all as one, okay? So marine dinosaurs, they wouldn't have gone on the ark because they're not land-dwelling. Okay, but the land-dwelling dinosaurs and the birds of the air, as the Bible says, so the flying dinosaurs would have gone on Noah's Ark. It's clear they matched exactly. As for when they were created the same day as man or the day before, because on day five you had the birds of the air and the fish of the sea. That would have included all things that fly, so that would have included the flying dinosaurs. And on day six, God would have created the land dinosaurs. Okay, so they were created alongside man, lived alongside man, and would have gone onto the ark. Okay, very simple. As for, I will very briefly touch, because you could go on ages about this, about how dinosaurs got onto the ark. The very simplest explanation, or how dinosaurs fitted on the ark, the simplest explanation is that in the museum back in the UK, and I'm sure John has got several over here as well, we've got dinosaur eggs. And you can find dinosaur eggs all over the world, okay? And the biggest dinosaur eggs are about that big. Alright. The biggest egg ever to have existed was about that big, and that belonged to a large bird, right? All dinosaur eggs were smaller than that. Majority of them about that size. So if you have an egg that size, and you have a dinosaur hatching out, how big is it gonna be? It's gonna be about that big tops, right? And, small dinosaurs are much easier to fit on large boats. And the ark would have been, as John mentioned earlier, very large, right? Also, it'd make more sense. God told the animals when they came off the ark to go and reproduce and repopulate the earth, right? So you're not going to have the really big dinosaurs. Because the one thing that I've learned working as a zookeeper is that reptiles grow all their lives. And the older they live to be, the bigger they will be. So when you find these really huge dinosaurs, they're the really, really ancient ones. In other words, not particularly good for repopulating the earth. You're going to go with the younger ones, right? So there's a little bit about, yeah, so dinosaurs, yes, on Noah's Ark. Second part of the question, yes, dinosaurs got on Noah's Ark, yes, dinosaurs got off Noah's Ark. Yes, people have lived alongside dinosaurs. And I think the biggest evidence that people have lived alongside dinosaurs are the legends of dragons. And as John said, there is a fantastic book, and I highly recommend the book myself, because it is amazing, very, very visual. The guy who did it, Vance Nelson, has done a really good job of making a really visual aid as to, you know, questions about the dinosaurs and dragons. But put very simply on a sort of a quick sort of everything in a nutshell, you find legends of dragons that sound exactly like dinosaurs all over the world, okay, with independently as well. So even though they all got slightly little quirks and stuff on, you know, added onto them, the general idea of this reptilian dinosaur-like creature is found all over the world in independent cultures, okay? And some of the descriptions that they give are spot on with modern-day dinosaurs. So how did they die out? Very simply, the first ever real proper climate change was at Noah's flood. That's when it went from a worldwide tropical kind of climate to suddenly you've got distinct climates. You've got the poles. You've got deserts. You've got hot, very hot places. You've got very dry places. The one thing that I know about reptiles is the majority of them have to live in warm and humid places. So you've instantly reduced the surface area of the land where dinosaurs can now survive. And then what do? Add in factors like hunting, add in factors like the world is not what it used to be, you know, plants are on their way down, dinosaurs are on their way down, the whole thing is devolution. This is what we see throughout animals all the time, getting smaller, losing genetic bottlenecks, stuff like that. And it's very easy to explain why the dinosaurs went extinct. But they would have lived on for a little bit longer because we still have passed down the legends of dragons. But I do highly recommend that book down there.
All right, just to finish off this section, then I'll do mine, and then Joseph and I'll come back for the last question time. If you've enjoyed what we did on fossils tonight, all the stuff on dinosaurs is in this book, right? So you'll find that book by Vance on fossils, brilliantly photographic, brilliantly visual, brilliantly easy to follow. You'll find that really helpful. Okay, I'm going
to... Can I just add on to the end of that, also around, because this is based on my talk, this DVD, which is also at the back, Dinosaurs Down Under Part 2, The Flood, is part of a three-part series which was filmed for, I think it was USA, wasn't it? USA Television, which interviews John talking about this. But this goes into a little bit more detail about specifically those dinosaurs being drowned and the evidence behind it, because there's a lot more I could have said, but didn't have time for tonight. So if you're interested in specifically what I was saying about the drowned dinosaurs, that's a very good resource there.
Thanks, Matt. I'll call you back in a little while. Let's finish off the night. I hope you turned that one off. I don't want to go twice out there. Note the emphasis again on research, because the Bible says study to show yourself approved under God. So you study God's word. And then it says you will love God with your mind. You'll have a reason for what you believe. Remember I told you about the young man who got permission from his college to do his work experience? Oh, there's Noah's Ark in the background. That's about the smallest it would have been. There's a fossil tree in the foreground. No roots, no branches. In fact, it's a flood deposit. But the one flood they don't want to go near is Noah's flood, because Noah's flood is mentioned in Genesis. Genesis is a work associated with the name Moses and Lyell's aim to get rid of Moses. And it's hard for people to believe that academics have actually been so brainwashed that they won't even think of Noah's flood to start with. So let's do a bit of research and help you understand how the layers get there. You see, there's a question that I often get asked. How could the Bible be true if the rocks are so old? You see, you and I are taught at school the rocks at the top are younger and the rocks at the bottom are older. And they took a glass of water and they shook it and it had pebbles and sand and mud in it. And then they stopped and the pebbles settled down, then the sand, then the mud. And the teacher said, see, that's how the rock layers fall. Which would be a wonderful experiment if the world was a glass of water. And you see, if the rocks at the bottom got there first and then the sand and then the mud, there's the next step. The animals in the bottom layer got there before the animals in the top layer. Ah, all of a sudden your rocks are turning into a history book. And then Charles Darwin comes along and says, listen, there's a change and it's caused by evolution. Millions of years of evolution. Therefore, the Bible couldn't possibly be true. Now, around Sydney, there are so many theological colleges that assume the scientist knows what they're talking about, and the scientist is unprejudiced. And he's just objectively telling you the world is really provably millions of years old, and they don't have a prejudice against Moses. No, that's their whole aim. You see, the Bible says, beware of false science. If you have the science of geology and its aim is to remove Moses from science, you need to know about that. You need to know how to test all things and hold fast that which is good. You need to know where to look up information. Go to Q&A there and insert flood or rocks or theistic evolution. You need to know the experiments we've done. Those of you who support our work, thank you. If you don't yet support our work, hint, hint, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. There's boxes up the back there for donations and all sorts of ways you can do it. See the students' legs? Question. Did the rock layer at the top get there last? Did the rock layer at the bottom get there first? Enter. Well, there's a young man from my church, SDR. He's got his degrees in engineering geology. He's up in northwest Queensland at the moment. We're experimenting with a machine. And there's my grandson, Ben, helping us out. What's Ben doing? Dumping mud of all sorts of stuff in there. We're pumping water through. Now, I didn't think of this experiment. A German did. Because, you see, at the university, a librarian came to me and said, have you ever read the works of Walter? And I said, no. And she said, I have an English translation. Now, this man was never mentioned in geology courses, but here's what he did. You've heard of Venice, the city that's sinking? He got a job to try and figure out why, so he walked along the mud, mapping the mud. And then he drilled down through the mud and mapped the mud. And he got a result that led him totally to reject the standard story that the bottom layer got there first. Because he reached the conclusion, this is a flood deposit, and the water's starting there and finishing there. The rocks at the bottom are not getting there first. The rocks at the left are getting there first, and the rocks at the right are getting there last. No, I didn't even think of the design of the experiment, because this comes from a French sedimentologist who, like me, discovered this Austrian's work and set out to see, can we test it? Hey, look, the water is coming from the right. The muck and the sand is piling in. See the different colours? The white ones, the black ones, and the grey ones are all different weights. Look, it's building up a pile. Look, the pile is growing from right to left. Look, after a few hours, look what's happening. There's flat layers and there's bent layers. Well, we could go on for hours because we filmed every bit of this. We videoed it. We took slides. We did it three or four times a night. And you can see there's a layer of flat stuff at the top. And you can see there's layers of inclined stuff. Have you seen that in the real world? If you haven't, let me take you to the Sunshine Coast. This is all Jurassic rock, by the way. Look at that lovely cliff. Get up close. How good are your eyes? You see, let's put our experiment beside it. Left-hand side's our experiment. Right-hand side's the real rock. Left-hand side took 2 hours. Right-hand side is supposed to be 100 million years old and taken hundreds of thousands of years to form. Ah, now this is not an exception. You see, here's the same formation in the USA. Where is that? The top layer in the Grand Canyon. Oh, why did I pick on the Grand Canyon? Because I was, I guess you could say, motivated to do this experiment, not just because there was a conflict between the glass of water experiment that's in the head of every geologist in this whole Australia, but because a professor of mine came into the room one day and he said, students, I've got some bad news. The Grand Canyon rocks grow old sideways. And the funny thing was, he never said another word in all the 5 years I studied geology. Not another word. And I thought, hey, what do I do now? I just filed it away. I'd encourage you, by the way, if you're stuck on Ezekiel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 9, don't get discouraged. Just have a big to-be-understood basket. One day you will understand it, and if you have to die first, just get in the line that's getting to Daniel to ask him what the answer is. Okay, you see, the professor was really saying the rock layers grow sideways. Just like the guy in Venice said. Just like the French sedimentologist who's proved to be unbelievably unpopular. Because if the rocks grow sideways, or there's a corollary here, you see, a dead fish over here in the top layer is actually younger than a dead fish over here in the bottom layer. And then you come along and you drill down and you look at the fossils in the bottom and you say they got there a long time before the ones in the top. And it's not true. The fossils on the left-hand side got there before the fossils on the right-hand side. And the fossils on the top are older than the fossils on the bottom. I'll tell you what, do you realize how much that ruins the theory of evolution? It really does. You see, the interesting thing is, rock layers can only form from water that's got mud and bits of rock in it. And the only water that's got rock and bits of mud in it is the water that moves sideways. It erodes things. Only moving water carries mud and sand, and it moves sideways. And the layers grow horizontally. And the bottom layer does not get there first. Am I losing you? Because you see, creation research. Not just creation interest, but you see, you and I have just found something the average student is lied to. The average theologians think given long enough you can build up all the rock layers. They don't even know about the fact that real world water moves sideways. Noah's flood, the rain came down. It filled up the land and the rivers and moved sideways due to gravity. The fountains of the deep broke open and there's two tides each day moving sideways. It didn't behave like the cup of water at all. Not time, but process. And let me finish off with this. You pick the wrong process, the cup of water, and then follow it on. The bottom layers got there first. The animals in the bottom are older. You reach the theory of evolution and you can... By the way, the devil's tricky. Do you realize most lies, the best lies, are mostly the truth? You'd never believe them otherwise. It's true. If you get a glass of water and shake it up, the heavy bits get to the bottom. But in our experiments, the heavy bits are actually on the top. Ah, if you don't know why, ask me later. But you see, if you have the wrong process, you'll end up rejecting in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth. Do you know why? You've forgotten something. God didn't even need those 6 days to make the heavens and the earth. He could have done it just like that. Because that's how he healed people, wasn't it? You see, the interesting thing is, if you end up with the wrong process for making rocks even, you'll say evolution is true and Exodus is impossible. There's no way you can believe that chronology. There's no way you can believe in Noah's flood. The Bible is not possible to believe. And then you end up rejecting that. All things were made by Jesus. And that's where we left you this morning, wasn't it? You see, the interesting thing is, if evolution is true, Jesus turns out to be impossible to believe. The guy who helps Joseph on our field trips now wasn't a Christian a couple of years ago. And there's a DVD up the back called Time's Up Darwin, which goes into some of these processes, and the Lord used it to open up his mind. He'd been lied to. I remember sitting on the beach at Newcastle. I'd taken a guy, a high-up academic from one of the hospitals on a field trip, and here he is sitting down having lunch, talking to himself, muttering. And I went up and said, "What's the matter? Why did they lie to me, John? Why did they lie to me? I saw the evidence myself today. Why did they lie to me?" He was shocked because his hidden assumption was professors and scientists are only interested in the truth. And they're not. They're interested in any explanation that leaves God out. My aim is to free science from Moses. Get rid of God. Get rid of 6 days. Get rid of judgment at Noah's flood. And you call that science. And then you pretend the conflict is science versus religion when it's not. It's truth versus error. Can I encourage you, in our last remaining question time, if you've got any questions about the flood, no, we could have covered lots more. This comes from a sort of a series that goes for 7 sessions. So you've just had a little bit of your eyeballs opened up. So we're going to have another 5 minutes or so of questions, 10 minutes or so. Have we got 10 minutes? Let's take them. Okay. Joseph, come and join us on this microphone. Anyone got any questions? Yes, mate. The biggest dinosaur. Joseph, do you have an answer to that?
Sort of. Basically, remember what I said earlier about the older dinosaurs were, the bigger they grew, right? So part of that is the biggest dinosaur we've ever found was one that was found in Argentina. It was one of the sauropod dinosaurs. That's the ones with the big long neck. And it was huge. I can't think what the name was.
Well, it ended up being called Supersaurus.
Supersaurus or something like that, yeah. But basically, out of all of your sauropod dinosaurs, the one with the big necks, big long necks, they were definitely the largest group of dinosaurs just because they were huge. But what they tend to do, what scientists tend to do, is have a look at them and put the smaller ones as one species and the larger ones as a different species, when in reality they are exactly identical apart from the size. Well, if you've got dinosaurs being closer to being created, therefore they are more healthy, therefore they can live a lot longer, just like humans could live a lot longer in the past, then you've got dinosaurs who could live for a very, very long time and get very, very large indeed. So the general answer to your question is the large sauropod dinosaurs were the biggest dinosaurs, the ones with the big long necks, and there were several different types, we know that, but the large Supersaurus or Ultrasaurus, they tended to be the largest dinosaurs, but they were probably the same, just older ones.
Good question. Anybody else? Yes. How did they get the blue whales onto the ark? Well, Professor Ian Plimer was the first to go into print in Australia asking that question, and in reality, it's not a sensible question from a professor who should have read the textbook, e.g. the Bible, where it says God sent to Noah two of every land-dwelling, air-breathing creature, because a blue whale does not need to be rescued from water. It lives in the water. It was having a whale of a time during Noah's flood. The flood is not a threat to any sea creature at all, unless it's going to be buried by mud that's pouring in. But the one thing we've noticed in things like tsunamis, right, there are no fishes that end up dead, right, because the water comes in, but the animals disappeared days earlier, and the fishes disappeared, right? They seem to know, or at least God tells them somehow, but they just disappear. It's only the people who get caught by these massive sudden turbulences. In Noah's flood, I'm sure it would have affected many creatures, but whales, no, whales did not need to go on the ark, so Noah didn't need to build a 100-foot, 30-meter-long aquarium at all. Okay, anybody else? While they're thinking, would you like to advertise your two books?
They're not my personal books.
No, they aren't, are they?
Now, a couple of things that they've helped me as I've been studying paleobiology, particularly this one. The great thing about this one is, well, first of all, it is very visual. You can see. Let's have a look inside and get some. It's a lovely sort of coffee table book, but it is full of marvellous pictures. But the great thing about it, it's about living fossils. Living fossils was a term that Charles Darwin himself came up with to basically, it was the name that they gave to any kind of fossil creature that was exactly identical to the ones that were alive today. And it's helped me greatly in my studies because it has very visual aid to show you that actually there is only two options in the fossil record. They're either exactly the same as they are today, or they've got smaller and died out. There's no evolution in the rocks at all. And this is one of the best evidences that you can find here. And the great thing about this particular book is this guy, Carl Werner, who went all over the world, interviewed hundreds of scientists, visits hundreds of museums, and put it all together. So it is basically lifetime's work in one book. So it saves you going and doing it all yourself. You can see the real evidence there in front of you. So that's a really good one. Another one, this is more of a sort of a general...
That's an Australian book,
yes, written by an Australian as well, Dr. John Ashton. But it's a very good kind of overview of all the kind of evidence. It covers things like fossils, covers things like genetics, biological evolution, stuff like that. So it's a very sort of a very good, very well written general overview of all the evidence for creation and against evolution. Very easy to read as well. And yeah, highly recommend it.
All right. Anyone got any last question? Your chance? Yes, sir. Okay, the thing that convinced me, right, because I didn't become a Christian through going to revival meeting or going to church or anything, my favourite book was an evolutionist book, and as I shared before a few years ago, the author started to poke fun at the existence of God and at the Bible, and his arguments were so stupid that I, as an unbeliever, felt, this is ridiculous, I can't believe this stuff is in a science book, so I picked up a Bible to see what it said. But I had the ability then, I'm pretty sure it's a God-given gift. When you read Genesis, you notice 10 times it says God created things after their own kind. And yet in my head was monkeys changing into a different kind, fishes changing into a different kind, and they were obviously at odds with one another. So I would file that away, and after many years of geological study, it hit me. Okay, I'm doing really well in fossilology, right? Paleontology, call it what you will, right? And the thing that became remarkably obvious to me, we had a textbook by Professor Carter, and he said, the evidence shows that once a creature appears in the fossil record, it continues basically unchanged or it dies out. Okay, that doesn't fit with evolution at all. They appear essentially the same way they are today. Hence the term living fossils, such as this book. So from my perspective, the thing that got to me was that I could not believe in evolution, because if you ask the honest question, what would the evidence be? The evidence would be molecules turned into amoebas, that turned into worms, that turned into fishes, and you'd have to see it. Hence in the debate where Professor John, whatever his name was, said, there are precious few intermediates. I agree with you totally, sir. There are none, actually. They're where you can join one creature to another and show it turned into a different kind. So you'll find, I've used that very successfully in debates and in convincing others they are foolish to believe in evolution. Now what's your alternatives? Right, so personally, that's my big one. Joseph, what would you say?
I would say, and I'll try and for those who came on the field trip, you and we basically took you through this, but I'll explain it for everybody else as well. Remember what John was saying about earlier. Where did this idea of the millions of years actually come from? Because the interesting thing is it didn't come from science. It came from a man's agenda to get rid of the Bible from science, right? Charles Lyell, let's get rid of Moses from science. So the whole concept of millions of years, the whole concept of a very old earth, very long time periods, came not from science, but from an agenda to get rid of the Bible. So is there a way that we can conclusively prove that the dates are complete rubbish? Yes, there is. Simply by going to any particular geological formation and doing a very simple maths equation, okay? What you do is you go online or you go onto like the geology information boards that you can find there, and you go to a geological formation and you find the supposed age at the bottom of the formation and the supposed age at the top of the formation. Now the formation which I'm going to use for this illustration is a place called Hunstanton. It doesn't matter, you don't know where it is, it's over in my part of the world, about 20 minutes drive from where I live, okay? But you can do this on any kind of geological formation. But I can tell you that the rocks at the bottom of Hunstanton Cliff are supposed to be 110 million years old. And the rocks at the top of Hunstanton Cliffs are supposed to be 100 million years old. So that tells you that the time that those cliffs took to lay down is a supposed 10 million years. Okay, you all following? Yeah, good. Then what you do is you take the height of the cliffs. Now, I can tell you that the height of the cliffs at Hunstanton are about 20 metres tall. 20 metres is 20,000 millimetres, okay? It's just another way of expressing it. So what you do is you take your 20,000 millimetres and you divide that by the supposed time those cliffs took to lay down, i.e. 10 million years. What figure do you come up with? Well, the answer is 0.02, which is all very well unless you actually know what 0.02 actually means. And what that is the amount of sediment in millimetres that was being laid down every year if you take those dates as accurate. In other words, only 0.02 millimetres of sediment was being laid down each year if those dates are right. Now, through Hunstanton cliffs, you get fossils. You get fossil belemnites about that big. You get fossil brachiopods or seashells, which are about that big. You get fossil clams or, you know, cockle shells, which are that big. You get ammonites, which are that big. Here's the question. If you take those supposed dates as being accurate, and you work out how much was being buried, how much sediment was being laid down every single year, you work out that it would have taken around 18,500 years to bury one of those single little shells. Here's the question. If it really took that long, would you ever get that shell buried? No, it would have rotted away and been destroyed long before. Would you have ever got it fossilised? No, it would have been destroyed within a matter of, you know, a couple of years tops, right? So the beauty of that equation is that it is a simple maths equation. You're just dividing. It can't be wrong. Maths is one of the few sciences that is absolute, okay? So it can't be wrong. And you're only putting in two types of data. One of them is the height of the cliff. And if you want to deny the height of the cliff, you can go jump off of it and see what happens. All the supposed dates. One of them has to be wrong. And the only conclusion that you can come to is that the dates are wrong, because they are ludicrous results. And there are people who have, agreed with this. One of them, as we mentioned yesterday on the field trip, was Professor Derek Ager, who said the results are ludicrous. They were his words. He said ludicrous. He said it's ridiculous, these kind of ideas. The dates, you know, they can't possibly be right. And I have used that up against geologists and other people in university and in debate. I know John has as well. And we have never received a critique or an answer to that problem, simply because you're using a very basic maths equation, using their supposed dates and, flipping them on themselves. And so that, I think, is one of the most powerful evidences against the millions of years, because you can destroy it with a drop of a hat, because you would not get a single fossil. In fact, I'll go one step further and say not only would you not get a single fossil, you would never get a deposit in the first place, because we know rates of erosion, and we know at that slow a deposit, that would just be eroded away before it had even chance to settle. So you would never get a deposit at that rate.
Okay, let me just finish off then. If you've been blessed by today, then promise to pray for us over the next 6 weeks, because we have a lot of journeys from here to Tasmania, to Adelaide, to the centre, and back again. You're going to get to look at that big rock out there.
I'm going to have to look at a big rock, yeah.
Yeah, I'm really thrilled, because the people out there who wanted us to come said, we know Joseph is trained to be a geologist. We'll pay your airfare out here. And I can always accept that. That's a wonderful gift. And so praise the Lord for them. And our contacts out there largely come through Vision Radio. You'll see us on Vision. Well, you won't see us on Vision. You'll hear us. You know, the funny thing was, my granddaughter, I said I'd been listening to the wireless, and she said, "What's the wireless?" And I had to explain. It was like a television without pictures. And that communicated, but we live in a different world. But Christian radio is a great means of reaching out, and we can guarantee the quality of content, the biblical content you hear when we're being interviewed. If you're not in our newsletters, put yourself on there, encourage us with your purchases, and use them for witnessing as well. We'll hand back to you, sir, to close the night.